So this is a fairly short talk, about half an hour, and we'll have time for some questions after. Yeah, I think it's good to come back to the Buddha with a lot of these things. And from the texts that come down to us, it's clear that the Buddha was someone with a really exceptional gift. I guess that's really obvious. A gift of imagination. And, I mean, if you think about the Buddha, probably sort of can't in a way. But he, I mean, just think about it. He's a human being, just like us, right? He's got exactly the same basic experience. You know, he, like us, he saw things, heard things, smelled things. You know, he had ideas, experienced pleasure and pain, felt emotions, the same kind of mind. But he also had this amazing ability to grasp the essentials, to grasp the essence of things. He was kind of a very pithy sort of person. And along with that ability to see the essential point, he had tremendous feeling for others and tremendous empathy. So he could look at someone and really see them. And he could use his imagination to help other people pinpoint whatever were the important issues of their own lives. You know, so he didn't just tell them, he got them to see it, you know, so that they could see a way out of their dissatisfaction, distracted mental states, whatever it happened to be. And for the Buddha, the real essence, the thing that really was essential in everyone, in all people, as well as being essential just in the nature of everything, was the mind. You know, the mind that we're using now, the mind that we are using to understand, trying to figure out what I'm saying. You know, it's the mind that feels, it's the mind that somehow holds everything. And the Buddha saw that that's where all problems, as well as all solutions, come from, the mind. And you can see that, you know, in a way the Buddha, it was his main interest, in life was this. So it's not surprising that one of the really early sayings of the Buddha that are recorded is about this. It's about the omnipresence of the mind. It's everywhere. It's the essential thing about life. And he says, and you've heard this before, probably, experiences are led by mind. Experiences are preceded by mind. Experiences are produced by mind. So if you act or you speak with an impure mind, problems are inevitable. So it's just like when you get an ox, this is India, right? You get an ox and you tie him to a cart. When the ox moves forward, the cart comes along with the ox. The cause and effect relationship are as straightforward as that. So our experiences are preceded by mind. Our experiences are led by mind, and our experiences are produced by mind. So if you act or speak with a pure mind, happiness is inevitable. You know, it's just like the Buddha said, it's just like when the sun shines. When the sun shines, you get a shadow appearing on the wall behind you. It's as straightforward as that. So the mind really is the key to everything. It's the key to change. It's the key to liberation. Happiness, wisdom, compassion. And the Buddha taught lots and lots of ways of working with the mind. And he was a living example of them as well, because he practiced what he recommended. So we've got descriptions of what the Buddha was like from the early texts, like the Purabeda Sutta. And this, I mean, I was a bit surprised when I read this, because I think of the Buddha as a teacher. Right? So I tend to think of him as doing a lot of talking. and kind of associate him with what he said. But that's because all the scriptures are about what he said. But of course, the man himself might have been a bit different, and apparently he was. He didn't go on and on all the time. He was apparently quite restrained in his speech, and he only spoke when it seemed appropriate. A lot of the time, he was quite quiet, really. And that's probably why he was called Shakyamuni, the silent sage of the Shakya clan. So he's quite, you know, he's careful with talking. And when he did speak, apparently, his words never had that edge of irritation, which you sometimes get, you know. At the same time, he didn't have any of that awkwardness you get when someone's a bit anxious about how they're coming across. And at the same time, he never had that kind of pushiness that you also sometimes get when someone's trying to, you know, make sure that you're getting this. There's no kind of arrogance there. So it came across at once, this is all in the text, you know, it came across at once that this was someone with no strong desire for a particular outcome in this exchange. So he was very gentle and easy to be with. What really struck people, apparently, was that Buddha was moderate. I use this word, moderate. You know, you never got a bad feeling from his sense of conviction. You know, he was convinced about what he was talking about. He was very confident, but there wasn't a kind of obsessive edge around it. He didn't have a big issue about it, in a way. Presumably because he was quite clear, quite fearless in a way, so he could be relaxed and gentle with what he was putting across. And it was obvious that he didn't consider himself superior to you. It's quite interesting, you know. So this put you at your ease. He didn't think of himself as inferior to you either, you know. And also, he never gave you the sense that he felt you were equals, either. In other words, there's none of that comparison, none of that comparative evaluation that I think normally kind of goes on in our exchanges. It's quite a rare thing, and it seems that the Buddha was completely at peace with himself. And that created this special quality of friendliness in his exchange with others. And of course, like everyone who's famous, which he was in his day, he had lots of enemies or people that had were a bit dismissive about it. And people are always talking about the Buddha and his ragged community of beggars. You can imagine that, you know, they weren't necessarily thought of as something wonderful. And they often got criticised and accused of all kinds of misdemeanours. But none of that ever bothered the Buddha. He's just not bothered by it. If it was true, he just did what he could to sort it out. If it wasn't true, he never got upset that people were saying all these things. And I think the crucial thing is he never got caught up in non-existent problems. I think this is something that people often do. And the Buddha knew that one way or another, this was the kind of mind that everyone needs to create for themselves. This kind of very creative, but sort of unfazable mind. A mind that sees opportunities rather than problems. So he taught the kind of behaviour, the kind of meditation, the kind of mind cultivation, and the kind of wisdom that would develop that kind of mental atmosphere, you could say. So acting, meditating and viewing things that way, you'd simply develop a new kind of mind. And that new mind, it would still be you, you know, with your own unique character, but essentially it'd be similar to the Buddha's mind. That is relaxed, moderate, at peace, and not caught up in unnecessary problems. This creative, unfazable mind. And these three trainings in behaviour, meditation and wisdom, they combined in what the Buddha called the practice of sati sampajanya. Now, sati sampajanya means mindfulness and clear comprehension. And nowadays we shorten that to just mindfulness. This is what we mean when we say mindfulness. And mindfulness was the Buddha's core practice. And he said he called it the direct way. The direct way of cultivating the awakening that he'd realized. And nowadays it's amazing that, you know, a simple application of mindfulness is now really popular in the mainstream of National Health Service, business and so on. It's a really huge thing that's been taken up. Someone nowadays can become a mindfulness therapist without knowing anything about Buddhism. And people complain about that. They say, well, this is going to water Buddhism down, it's going to water the Dharma down. But I think surely it's a good thing that mindfulness, even if it's a bit elementary, it's out there, you know, in the mainstream. And the thing is, it frees up the experienced Buddhist teachers and mentors, Kalyana Mitras, to teach the Dharma more deeply and more explicitly. And it frees us up in a way. And it's also quite a big challenge, I think, to come up with the real thing. And I hope this new book I've written, I should have brought a copy in with me to display, but never mind. I hope this new book is going to help with that. And I very much hope it's going to help more people appreciate the incredible potential of the Buddhist path and to bring that to life in themselves. And so let me just say a little bit about what I've written. I won't say too much because I'd like us to have some time for questions. And of course it's about meditation. And plus lots that explores the ethical and the practical conditions that help you to meditate. And also the cultivation of wisdom through meditation. In the Buddhist tradition, there's a very, very large number of different meditation practices. And historically, it's been Buddhism. Buddhism has specialised in meditation, I don't think we can say. And the Buddha is said originally, himself, personally, to have taught 40 distinct methods. And that's already quite a few. But over the 2,500 years since his day, it's been hugely elaborated. So now there are many, many, many more than that in the tradition. And we in the Tree Ratna community, we draw upon just some of those, you know. And that's what I've written. I've written about the ones we recommend. We do recommend quite a number of less known meditations that are useful in some circumstances. So I explore why you do those, you know, how they work, and I give some instruction as to how to put them into practice, how to explore those kind of practices. And some of those methods are quite advanced. So that means that for complete newcomers, there'll be a proportion of the book that at the moment they can't put into practice. But that doesn't necessarily matter, because just to read about a practice, I think that can help us to understand a point about the Dharma. Because each meditation comes from the Dharma, and it's a way to put the Dharma into practice and realise it. That's what meditation practices are. So, you know, for example, we won't all feel ready to meditate on Pratityasamutpada, right? Pratityasamutpada is based on the Buddha's experience of conditioned co-arising, which supposedly this was his central realisation. It was the realisation that sparked his full enlightenment, conditionality. Okay, we might not all feel ready to meditate on that, but on the other hand, if you're looking to go a bit deeper into the teachings of Buddhism, you'll soon come across this idea, and it's a real education to see how in the tradition, Pratitya Samuppada is actually applied in experience, in an actual meditation exercise. So it can be illuminating. You know, it can get your imagination going, and you get a new angle on that teaching. So because even reading about meditation can be useful, I've tried to make this edition a lot more readable. So you can, if you want, just read it through out of interest. The other edition, I always said to people, well, you wouldn't want to read through it like a book, you know. It's just a kind of reference. But I've tried to make this one a bit more so you could do that. It's not all advanced by any means, the material in it. I mean, most of what I say consists of in-depth instruction in the kind of meditation most of us are already doing. And in addition to that, there's material that's just a bit further on for beginners and regular practitioners. So it could help you explore your next step. For example, I explore the basic meditations, the mindfulness of breathing, which we did earlier on, the Mata Bhavana, and the just sitting practice. I explore those from the perspective of cultivating insight, as well as from the more basic perspective of cultivating tranquility of mind. Because in general, I'm setting up the principles that determine why we practice particular approaches, what those approaches can achieve, and how all the different approaches relate to one another in a whole system, a whole approach. And while I was doing the rewriting over, it's taken me a year, the last year, Sangharakshita, the founder of the movement, and Subhuti, who's one of his main followers, they started discussing the new, broader approach to our system of spiritual practice that we're just starting to hear about, a bit more about now. And they wanted to get me in the picture early on with this material, so I could write it, I could weave it into the new book. And I've done that. So I think, though, my way of expressing things is very different from Sangharakshita's and Subhuti's. I think this is going to be a useful hands-on guide to this new approach. According to the title of the book, there's first tranquility, learning how to calm and steady the mind. Then second, there's imagination, where you work in all kinds of special ways to deepen the practice. And then thirdly, there's insight and compassion. I like to use those two together, insight and compassion, where the transformation starts to change you fundamentally. It starts to change who you are. So first of all, we need to learn concentration and positive emotion, a loving mind, and express both of these in daily life. That's kind of it, isn't it, in a way? And that's done through mindfulness, through training in mindfulness. Mindfulness is what carries what you learn from meditation into your life, into your daily life. But actually, there's also a meditation that helps you establish this mindfulness. And I'm not thinking of the mindfulness of breathing, even though the words there in the title. I think that helps, but that's more about, at this stage, it's more about concentration of mind. You know, coming back to the breath and so on. Now, for me at least, it's just sitting that in particular helps establish mindfulness in this sense of connecting with daily life, of weaving the practice into our daily life. And because just sitting really means sitting and being open to what's real at the time, what's really real. And that openness is what's at the heart of mindfulness practice. It's simple receptivity, just the willingness to be open, truly open, to what's actually happening in your mind and outside of you as well. What's really going on? Beyond all the explanations that we have, all the ideas that we have about it, all the assumptions that we have about what's happening. Beyond all the emotional reactions to what we assume is happening. You know, beyond the strategies and the forward planning we're also involved in, around, in relation to, what we assume is happening. And in this practice, we try and get down to what is happening a bit more. That's the practice. So you can actively cultivate this openness, and it's a key thing, it's a key practice. Spiritual receptivity. However, I'd say just sitting is generally not enough on its own. You do need the loving mind, the loving mind of Metta-bhavana, and also the more concentrating, purifying attention that you generate through the practice we did at the beginning, the mindfulness of breathing meditation. So once you know those three basics, that's not enough just to know them, is it? It's not enough just to practice them from time to time. You need to sustain the practice. You need to put down roots somewhere. Meditation is great when you start, but you need to keep it up even when it's difficult. And that's obviously more difficult. And so I talk in the book about ways you can keep it alive. For one thing, it helps so much to go on retreat. And in the book I go into the principles of creating retreat conditions. Not only how to use retreat conditions when you get into them, but also how to create them for yourself. So you learn about all the special things that give extra support to meditation practice. There's really too much to go into now, but one very obvious consideration in sustaining the practice and putting down roots, if you like, is posture, just the way you sit, you know, the principles, the different ways to do that, and tips you can apply that are going to help stop your toes going numb, or, you know, your back seizing up, or whatever particular things happen to you when you don't sit so well in the practice. So as we progress in meditation, various signs appear, various changes appear, and you get different, more unusual mind experiences that can be wonderful, or they can be downright weird, but whatever they are, they can be easily misunderstood. So it's a good idea to learn something about the principles there. You know, the mind does have all these amazing capabilities, and we can all taste some of those. Like dhyana, for example, someone was talking about to me about that just now, higher consciousness. It's good to understand the value of such an experience. For example, that higher consciousness, to give it that name, is not the end point of the practice. It's not quite what you're aiming for. It's more of a spin-off effect of just going deeper. But at the same time, it might not be the aim, but at the same time, it's really useful to cultivate it to whatever extent you can. And sometimes people find this hard to understand, the relationship between the various stages of meditation practice. And I've got quite a bit to say about this kind of thing. And in doing so, I hope I managed to indicate as well something deeper about the kind of reality that we're all living in. You know, just now I was talking about openness, about how we have almost like a wall of preconceived ideas about what's happening in any given moment. Well, this shows that the world we usually experience is not really how it is. And it's once you start wondering about that and seeing that and tapping into that a bit that the real transformation starts happening. So the later chapters in the book are more about that area, about the cultivation of wisdom, you know, the various approaches to wisdom, and also the pitfalls. You know, it's always useful to have some sense of the mistakes you can learn to avoid. You know, sometimes it's helpful to make mistakes, but as long as you understand that that's what they were, that's useful. And also to understand that some things that appear to be problems are just actually stages on the way. That's an important thing to learn. So that's just some of the content of the book. I can't it'll be too much to go into it in more than that. But overall, I would really like my book to contribute to everyone's ability to imagine and envision what the spiritual path is. Because in your meditation practice, and in my practice as well, what's really important is that the view of what it is you're trying to do. You know, get the view right, and the path is going to unfold in the best possible way. You know, that was the Buddha's teaching of the Eightfold Path. You know, first comes the vision, and out of that comes the transformation. And our own overview, we've all got one, however new or however well established we are, we've all got an overview, and it's going to be imperfect. It obviously needs working on, but as we open up and as we understand better what progress is, our view is going to improve. And that view, or that attitude, is going to directly affect how we practice. And on the basis that you practice meditation and you get its fruits, you get its results. But people often ask, when do we get these fruits? When do we get these fruits of the practice? And I think people often expect that the results of meditation should show up in the meditation itself, even in the very same session that they're engaged in at the time. So you're sitting there, you're making an effort to engage with the practice, and you know, by effort in this context, I of course mean the effort to relax. It's a very special kind of effort, facing towards your experience openly and re-engaging it again and again with the object of the meditation, picking it up again and again, which might be the breathing. And depending on the various conditions in your life, like when you got up this morning, it may not seem to be working very well. So you stay with the breath for a while, then you drift off, thinking about something you need to do later on, a really important thing, or whatever it is that grabs your attention. And the practice just continues like that, you know, one distraction after another, until the end. Finish. Time to do something else. But still, you did manage to keep remembering and coming back to the object. And now, people who have that experience often think, well, that was horrible. You know, that didn't work. That was a bad meditation. Now, the reason anyone has this view that it didn't work is that they're fixated on a particular kind of result. There's some idea they have, probably some image of their being very concentrated, very engaged. But it's not the right view. If you really do keep re-engaging with the breathing, you will definitely experience the positive fruits of those efforts later on. You know, you put in the effort in that meditation practice, later on, something's going to come out of that. You've laid down certain conditions in your mind stream. So later on, in another meditation, perhaps, it's a bit easier. Later on, in your own thoughts, as you walk down the street, there's a dropping in, perhaps, to some new thoughts about something, some more deeper thought. Or later on, in a conversation, you just notice there's a change. Or later on, in deep thoughts that come up in the middle of the night. So I think all our actions do have consequences, you know, and some actions have deep consequences. Meditation does. In traditional terms, meditation is a weighty karma or a weighty action. It's a substantial act with substantial consequences. So don't underestimate the effect of the practice, and you shouldn't expect the result to come immediately. It's all about just laying down these conditions. You're not really quite sure how or when they're going to affect things. So that's when it might happen, but what are the fruits that we might expect? Well, actually be careful, again, not to have to exact expectations of how things are going to unfold. Because everyone is different, and the older I get, I notice people are very different from each other. It's not just different. It's beyond, the differences are beyond belief. And then the most important fruits of meditation are the subtle fruits. The subtle fruits. And I'll just give one example, and that's in this amazing faculty of empathy that we have. You know, really, I think the most essential thing you're doing when you meditate is getting familiar with your own mind. And this is something amazing. It's a very long process. I mean, it just unfolds over your whole life. But it's a long process also because we have so many opinions already about who we are and what our mind is. You know, and all of these deeply held opinions, and also very emotionally held opinions, they need at least revising. At least they need revision. They need to reconsider. But actually, most of them just need abandoning. Completely abandoning. I mean, and I think meditation helps that by bringing us closer and closer to the reality of our own minds. And as you do become gradually more familiar with your own mind, just through connecting with it more closely, more deliberately, and on the way to that becoming more receptive, becoming more easy with yourself, because you see things that you in the end just have to accept, you didn't really know they were there. And you become more confident with that because it's fine. At the same time, you're becoming more familiar with what it is to have a mind in the first place. Because everyone has a mind. Everyone has this experience of mind. But they don't normally think about that because it's so basic. They don't normally think about that. So in all of us, there's this very, very basic thing that can remain completely unrecognized and completely unrespected or unappreciated. But meditating, you train in recognizing this something. You know, we go beyond description at this point. This quality of experience that can't even be described adequately. But it's right there all the time. In all our experience. And this growing understanding of the quality of mind in all things, it automatically links you with other people. Very intimately. It helps you and teaches you to understand all other people. And that's how the Buddha became like he did. And it's how we become like the Buddha. And I'm not going to say any more, because that's it, in a way. And there's too much else to say. But very generally, I hope very much that this new book is going to help support and advise everyone's meditation practice, including my own. Either because you yourself buy it and study it, or because the teachers around you do that and they pass it on. We all know that reading a book isn't a substitute for actual practice. But it can clarify our understanding and then get us practicing. So it'll help us, I think, to practice imaginatively and perhaps insightfully and I really hope enjoyably. So this is my great wish. That's it, really.
Thank you.
Anyone got any questions or any topics they'd like to raise for discussion? You know, we did that meditation this morning. That might have been somewhere where questions arose in your minds, or
I've got a question.
Yeah. Okay.
It's really a basic one. It's something
good.
For me is always an issue. If I try to do mindfulness breathing,
yeah.
I start controlling my breath. So it comes like a yoga pranayama rather than meditation. So little tips on.
Yeah, I think with that, just let it be like that for a while, and don't worry about it, don't be concerned about it, because it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. I mean, it just adds to the problem to be concerned about it, because in a way, it's all about experiencing the quality of the breath. If the quality of the breath is controlled, or it's awkward, or it's not an easy breath, it doesn't really matter from the point of view of the... You're not trying to learn to breathe well. If you breathe well, that's good. If you don't breathe well, it's irrelevant from the point of view of doing the meditation practice, because it's about just bringing awareness to one point. So it doesn't really matter. With meditation, you can meditate on any object, really. This just happens to be the breath. If the breath is a bit controlled or there's some sort of habit around it, that's okay. And actually, it's very interesting because so much of our breathing is governed by emotion. The way that we breathe in particular circumstances is, it might not be consciously controlled, but it's certainly unconsciously controlled. So a lot, and this is also something you learn from doing the practice, is by feeling that, you sort of learn quite intuitively about how your mind is, because there's a very strong relationship between the subtlety of different states of mind and the way that we're breathing. So the fact that you notice that you're controlling your breath like pranayama or something like that, just really notice that, and it might be interested in the quality of the breath from that point of view, if you like. I don't mean intellectualising and thinking about it, but feeling that. Now, that's completely okay. And it's really interesting, isn't it? I don't know if other people have that experience.
Can you say a little bit more about what you talk about in the book about the difference between practicing, say, the mindfulness breathing on that problem from a, as an insight practice or as a tranquility practice? I suppose my perspective is that I think you can spontaneously do one within those. And I get a bit cross with other schools of Buddhism that think or say to me, you're doing shamatha practices, we're doing insight practices, and I don't think it's that straightforward.
So what's the question?
The question is
that a statement or a question?
What do you say in the book about that area, about how you is it about cultivating it differently when you're actually doing it, or is it a natural progression?
It's a kind of big question, isn't it? It's about the relationship between what we call shamatha, which is the calming aspect of meditation, where you really your mind becomes rich, your mind becomes calm and easy and relaxed, and you can just sit there for ages because it's sort of all flowing, as it were, and it feels wonderful. This is the shamatha aspect. And then that the vipassana aspect is when you're actually looking at the nature of the mind. You think, oh, what is this? This is nice, but what is it? That's the vipassana, you know. What is it? What is going on? Who am I? What is life? You know. These really big existential questions. The shamatha gives you the mental health, if you like. You know, it gives you an ability to look into things with a completely detached, positively detached mind. So you can really, in a really relaxed way, look at things and see into them. And that's the relationship between those two kinds of meditation practice. Very, very different. It couldn't be more different, if you like. So the vipassana method is a bit more thinking. So you, at first, at least, so you might say, "Oh yeah, this is impermanent. You know, the mind is changing. My life is changing all the time. Isn't that interesting? My whole experience of mine is of." Changing experiences, and you sort of look into that, and there's a kind of insight that can come out of that. Now that's deliberately applying a method, right? So you might look at the impermanence of the breath. That's it. But at the same time, it might spontaneously arise to you. I think this is part of your question. Those reflections might spontaneously arise in your mind, and so I think there's a million different kinds of methods you could choose, and in a way, you come to them yourself as to how to approach Vipassana, you know, in relation, talking to other people, and getting some advice, probably, about how to approach it. But in the end, you kind of find out how to do those practices and make them work and make them effective just through doing them and experimenting and so on. I don't know if it's anywhere near the, your question, but your question is so enormous that I don't know how to answer it. And I can't speak for other schools, other approaches. I can a bit. But the thing is, it's all individual people say individual things. So one person who says something isn't necessarily representative of a whole bunch of people. And I think we have to be careful about tarring everyone with the same brush, as it were. It's okay if you. But the Buddhist tradition is pretty clear right across the board, and you've got all these different cultural or modern or ancient different traditions, and they have their own approaches. We've got a particular approach. Ours is pretty broad. Sorry, that's not an answer.
Just speaking to that, wouldn't our approach be what you said about building up a positive, kind of mentally healthy,
that's possible,
robust mind before we go to the Vipassana, rather than going first to the Vipassana without that basis? Well, I'm just wondering if that's more than you.
I don't think it's as simple as that, because is this Vipassana? It starts when you do some Dharma study, really.
Yeah.
It starts when you just start learning a bit about Buddhism, because Buddhism is all about that. It's all about liberation. Liberation involves looking at what is going on. So I think there are just different aspects to it. You need to understand, you need to have a little bit of curiosity and interest in Vipassana. As soon as you start taking it up, you're already reflecting on it. So you realise that in order to really do this, it would be good to have a deeper shamatha, deeper meditation. So those two things, they can go hand in hand. So you could say logically that you need to develop this huge amount of shamatha before you should ever consider taking on any Vipassana. But you forget the fact that you're actually making it already.
It's just one thing that happened to me last week, which you've explained before, is that I've been quite stressed recently about doing things intellectually and, you know, sort of easing things. And I did the mindfulness of breathing. And after I had done that, I came out of the room and, you know, my husband was at home. And I really felt very, very panicky.
That's good.
And I just wanted to sit very in quiet.
Yeah.
And just sit with this and find out.
You didn't want to have a conversation with your husband, for example, or you just wanted to be quiet.
It was really important to sit with this, whatever it was, because I didn't know what it was.
Yeah. Need to absorb it somehow.
And then the TV came on and the discussion happened and it went.
Yeah.
But I've never felt. Yeah. Like I really needed to connect with whatever it was, and that was just so important. And I'm sure it will happen again, the time will come again. But I've never really experienced that, and although I was panicky, I wasn't afraid of being with it.
Yeah, okay.
But that's the first time.
I think sometimes, yeah, you said that your rest of your life is a bit stressed, and so in a way, the rest of your life wasn't the best conditions to absorb that particular practice. But at the same time, you could do that to some extent, but you would have liked to have done it more. and you could really feel the contrast. And so, yes, it sounds like you really assessed somehow what was going on, what you needed. You weren't able to provide it for yourself, but that sounds good. You know, that you're in touch with that, and you could feel the need. It would have been good if you could just had a bit of space for a little while. Yeah, but I'm sure there's no permanent damage or anything like that. It's a good experience overall, isn't it? It's quite mixed, but it's a good thing overall.
It's quite insightful.
Yes, it's quite insightful, yeah. Yeah. Is it, and something like that happens, it's completely unprogrammed.
And it was a surprise.
It's a surprise, yeah. And so the substantial action, substantial effects.
Thanks. I've got two unrelated questions. The first question is, how important is dhyana, and in what extent would you advise that we should seek out dhyana in regular meditation practice? And my second question is a slightly more particular thing.
Why don't we do one at a time?
Okay.
I think it's tremendously important, dhyana. I mean, it is the quality of the mind becoming more concentrated, more deep, and so on. And there are so many degrees of it, you know, from what we call access concentration right up to the fourth dhyana. There are other aspects to it as well. I think it's important for everyone to develop some degree of that. I think it's less important for... It depends on so many things. It depends on the time, how much time you've got to explore meditation. Very often it seems to be partly a temperamental thing. Some people seem able to really go deeply into those states of mind. I'd encourage them, really. I think it's good. If you've got the time and the inclination and the inspiration to do that, I think that's great. I think everyone should go on retreat, do as much retreat as you can, and go as deeply into meditation as you can. That's a kind of general answer, actually. Okay, I have answered your question. But you may have another one.
Might kind of go with number two then.
Okay.
Which is something I'm kind of working on in general in meditation, and it certainly came up this morning, which is that sometimes when I sit down to meditate, I have a clear experience of, when I do mindfulness of breathing in particular, I have a clear experience of two things. One is a kind of breath, and the other is a kind of me. And the me generally is centered in my head, and kind of separate from the breath. And of course, we know from Buddhist Dharma that doesn't ultimately hold up, that there is no kind of fixed core identity, and occasionally I have sort of...
But that's your experience, isn't it?
But it is my experience, and I guess the experience is one of a kind of, it feels so solid, that sense of me in my head.
Well, just because we have an experience, it doesn't mean to say that that experience is a solid something, it's simply an experience. We don't even know what that is. Anyway, please continue.
Yeah, I think you're sort of... saying exactly how it is, that sometimes when I get really absorbed in the breath, I see that it breaks down a little bit, but actually there's a sensation of the head, there's a sensation of the breath, neither one is more me than kind of any other.
Yeah, it's an idea.
But nevertheless, the feeling of that sort of identity of me being in my head, it's often so strong and overwhelming, but I guess my question really is, what advice do you have kind of working on that, in the sense of trying to sort of dissolve that sense of fixed identity?
Well, I wouldn't have it as a kind of a project like that. I mean, in a way, it's neither good nor bad. It's not a bad thing. It's not something you need to get rid of. It's always going to be there. I mean, even the Buddha thought about me. He just saw quite clearly that it wasn't something fixed. It's just a natural thing in a way. And the more you can be less, yes, the more you can be less, the more you can be relaxed around that, the better. put it like that. I think the project is understanding what's going on and really being open to not knowing and be curious about it. And I think don't think of it as something good or bad, but think of it as something you don't understand. That would probably be the way forward. It's a mystery, isn't it? But it's something you can engage with. In a way, I wouldn't be too fixated on it either. But it's certainly a big thing, the sense of identification with particular experiences as me. Like, for example, if I have a particular responsibility, you know, you can see the kind of armour going around, this is me, you know. And you sometimes see people who are very identified with a particular role, and you think, come on, you know. And you can see them doing it. And we're doing that in subtle ways with all kinds of things. And usually that is the reasons why we hurt other people, hurt ourselves, do all kinds of little bits of damage, sometimes, usually quite slight, but sometimes really not slight at all. It's usually because of a very strong identification with particular things as me or mine or not yours or whatever. Yeah. This is a very, very interesting area, and Buddhism kind of majors on what it calls anatta or non-self. But don't get too focused on this idea that, oh, I don't exist, or people don't exist. Don't be too focused on that. Think of it as just an interesting area that we do have these strong feelings of identification. That's the interesting thing. It's not philosophy. It's not philosophy, it's practice.
Getting back to Diana, I've always struggled with this tension between doing a form meditation and then dhyana factors arising in the midst of, and you know, such as,
can you explain it at all?
Well, like a rapture, for example, so which has kind of an agitated energy. So it's just that, how do you explore those and yet hold the object? You know, you might have an object, you know, you might be setting an object such as the breath or loving kindness.
We're meditating on the breath, and you're actually really engaged with it. Mm-hmm. You're very relaxed with it. It's going really well, and it's beautiful.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful experience, and there's this sense of rapture, which could be very strong. Or it could be quite mild.
Yeah.
It could be just a sense of, this is lovely, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
So, what are you saying?
Well, I don't know, sometimes rapture can be quite agitated, actually.
Okay, so yeah, it's beautiful. It can be, wow, it's
can
fantastic.
Be kind of a,
so,
yeah, because
oh,
it
is so
can be a bit stage-like.
Yeah.
Or, I, you know, you, maybe, well, I mean, that's my tendency sometimes. If something new comes up and you start grasping at it, so then you get a bit stuck.
Well, I think the way forward is... beyond the sort of fizzy aspect of it.
Yes, yeah.
And into something more integrated.
Yeah. But I think you have to identify that's what that fizziness is.
I think so. I think
that
in
you
every
have to start recognizing what it is. This, you know,
it's mindfulness all the way. I mean, really,
right.
Whatever happens, really be interested in the quality of this.
Yeah.
And don't take it as some kind of given or some sort of... you always have the ability to look, if you like, and to assess it somehow. I don't mean necessarily in a very judgmental sort of way, but to feel the quality, feel the width, as it were.
I guess in a lightly hold the objects at the same time as the object of the meditation.
Is that the issue, that you lose the object?
It's
so exciting that you lose the practice.
That's right. Sometimes
that can
that
be
happens.
The case, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I think that's how
if you see that, if you notice that, then you realise, oh, I'm losing the very source of of the good things that are happening. So I need to balance out. So I think this is how the Buddha became more moderate.
Yeah.
It's all about the kind of a very really practice in the round, so to speak, really really, really include everything.
So. Yeah, so just going broader and broader. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't feel I've explained that very well, but it really depends on what happens in your particular practice. And I'm just aware that people here come from lots of different angles.
Yes,
I'm quite new to meditation, it's just about the idea of, I suppose, concentrating on my stomach as though being the centre of me.
You could do it that way. You could do it that way. Sure.
Because it's you know the act of closing your eyes and kind of not seeing, and therefore you know seeing from up here, as it were, rather than experiencing.
If that works for you, that's fine. Yeah.
But I felt the subtle
breeze
of it.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I'm sure you have. Yeah, Great. It was 1 o'clock, wasn't it?
1 o'clock. Yeah.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes left.
Can I quickly ask? What do you mean when you say dhyana? I don't.
Dhyana means. There are different. Dhyana means sort of higher consciousness. I've called it that. It's your mind. It's your experience of mind, but it's coming together in a very focused and relaxed way. The focus is one aspect of it, and the relaxation is another. So it's a very different sort of state of consciousness. Very positive, and there are different aspects of it. There's the emotional aspect, which I think you were going into, where it just feels lovely, and you've got the more I would call it intellectual, more the attention aspect is very clear and precise. So you've got this precision and accuracy and really fine pointed somehow. So you've got those two things coming together. And thought is very clear. Thought is very clear. If there are thoughts, and there may be very, very few thoughts, even the only thought could be is just the practice you're doing, as it were. It's very simple. There's another characteristic. It's very, very simple. So there are levels and degrees of this in meditation. And the first degree is when meditation becomes a bit easier. That's the first degree. It's called access concentration, when you start to get to a point where you're not having to you're not having to make an effort to stay in a concentrated state, so though you reach a plateau, if you like. And that's the first stage, and there are traditionally there's supposed to be 4 main dhyana stages, and at the different levels it becomes basically simpler, more concentrated, more enjoyable. That's you know, let's not go into all the technicalities, which you can look up. It's all in my book, if you want to read about it. But that's what jhana is.
Yeah.
Okay, you have to be the last one.
Okay.
You have the last word.
when you say enjoyable, I mean, I haven't experience it in a big way, like you talk, but I remember quite a long time ago I experienced something.
Yeah.
Actually, that's quite a beginner, that I would probably describe as dhyana, and I would also describe it as kind of energetic state. Automatic car changing gear into something. Something freeing, that kind of freeing.
The energy changes become something quite different. Mm.
Yeah.
Much brighter, more positive.
But also this would kind of happen without me really realising, and that kind of thing is quite a different experience when my body felt less tangible or something. And I would suddenly find myself there, and I'd become quite frightened. So when you say vegetable, I think, you know, I had the experience that
it's unfamiliar.
Yeah.
I think this is another reason why it's good to learn about this stuff, because then it's not, you just realize, I must be in the fourth jhana. You know, it's what it is. And there's less occasion for being freaked out by that.